and to get a grasp of what the measurements might be to help us understand whether we're achieving our goals as a basis for us to talk about future policy. It is not a meeting in which we are presenting policy or arguing about policy. It's trying to grasp and understand what is, and also if there's an opportunity maybe to hear from the departments about where they will be moving, making recommendations for movement in the future based on the directions we've given the department in the past. So with that, we're going to continue with our orientation to Children and Family Services. We had just begun this last time, and we'll be welcoming Erin Sullivan Sutton again, who is the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. Welcome to the table, and would you introduce yourself so the voice is clear that it's yours? Is this just audio taped, or is this also videotaped?
Both.
It's both. Okay. Okay,
thank
great.
You, Madam Chair, members. I'm Erin Sullivan Sutton, the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services.
Welcome.
So thank you for the opportunity to return and talk with you this morning and share with you some of the important work we do in the Children and Family Services area of the Department of Human Services. Our understanding is that you would like a high-level overview and the chance to ask questions. So what I'm going to do this morning is talk to you about some of the challenges we face and some of the challenges that people we serve face, as well as where we're going and how we measure whether we're making a difference or not. And we're happy to take any questions. I know our time is limited today, so if you do have detailed questions or want to hear more about particular programs or activities that we're engaged in, we're happy to meet with any of you individually. And Nikki Farrago, who's our legislative liaison, can help you with making those arrangements. So first I want to share with you what the mission and goals of the Children and Family Services areas are. One of the issues and challenges we face have to do with disparities. As you know, the disparities across population in Minnesota are alarming, especially for African American and American Indian people in our state. And one of the things that we see in our services is that disproportionality of these populations in terms of who's coming to access our services. In Children and Family Services, we work to achieve equitable outcomes for all of our clients. Although we can't cure the disparities within our state, we really work to try to make sure that people who come to our programs have equal access to positive outcomes in our services. As you'll see in a few moments, we've made some progress in some areas, but there are still other areas where we need to see more improvement. When Commissioner Jessen was here, she shared with you the framework for the future for 2013, and I just want to point out a couple of areas that are specific to Children and Family Services. As the Commissioner explained, this is not all of the work of the department, but these are some of the priorities as we move into the future. And in this area, we focus on people. We're working to better protect children and vulnerable adults in families and facilities, especially those that are directly in our care. We want to make sure that people are fed and healthy by increasing nutrition assistance, especially for seniors. One of the things that you may have heard is the work that we are doing to help people who are eligible for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program know about the program's existence and help work to help them apply for and get on that program when they are, in fact, eligible. We're also working to decrease the number of children in foster care who are waiting to be adopted. This is one of our key missions, is to make sure that all children in Minnesota have the opportunity to have permanent families in their lives. We are also working in the area of equity. I talked a little bit about disparities. We're really working to ensure that we're lowering the disproportionate number of children of color in out-of-home placements. We continue to have a higher number of African-American and American Indian children in out-of-home placement, and we're really working to ensure that those children, whenever possible, can be kept safely in their homes. And we want to increase access to high-quality child care. And with respect to integrity, we have some work in the Children and Family Services area with respect to integrity, but you will hear more about that when you meet with the Office of Inspector General. But we really want to reduce fraud and abuse and decrease the use of multiple EBT cards and establish authority related to child care assistance fraud that may be occurring by providers.
May I ask you a quick question
Sure.
here? This is the overview that the commissioner gave us of the overall goals and objectives, and you're highlighting those here that that really relate to the department that you are describing to us today. I really appreciate that, pulling those things out. And I'm really interested. I know that Senator Hayden is as well, to maybe at some point for the whole department to take a look at these equity issues, you know, what specifically we're talking about to capture and change that benchmark on the disparities of healthcare. On the first bullet there, you're talking about facilities that are, how is that articulated, that are directly in our care, that better protect children and vulnerable adults and families and facilities, especially those directly in our care. Could you define what is directly in your care?
So, for again, this is a department-wide initiative or goal. So we're working as a department to better protect vulnerable children and adults, as well as those that are directly in our care. So, you know, a large part of our department has responsibility for direct care and treatment, and that is under the leadership of Deputy Commissioner Ann Barry. So that would be the state facilities.
Thank you. I was thinking maybe there is a direct care facility that we have for children that I wasn't aware of, but we don't have a direct care facility for children.
There is a direct care responsibility for children in our what we call the MIF homes. So we have a number of treatment foster care homes that are under the responsibility
That's
of
right.
the department.
Okay, great. And then my second question is, when you're looking at the overall goal of all families and changing the disproportionate number of children of color, et cetera, have we a good solid analysis or understanding what is creating that problem in the first place so that our investments are directed towards the correct correction rather than, you know, we can set that goal, but there's something that drives the fact that more children of color are in foster care. Are we doing work to determine what drives that so that when we establish our funding policies that they are directed towards those things we think will impact or truly change that?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent segue into the things I'm going to talk about now in terms of some of the challenges and issues that people face that come to our programs.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
one
Senator
question.
Klassen. Yes.
Under integrity, that first bullet item on the EBT cards, could you just expand on that a little bit?
Sure, Senator Klassen. So Minnesota in the past has had, and the Department of Agriculture, which runs the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, has had concerns that we have issued multiple cards to the same individual. Many times that's for appropriate reasons. There's, you know, things that happen. People lose their cards. And so one of the things that you all have done is required us to put the name of the individual on the card to try to prevent fraud whenever possible so those cards cannot exchange hands and be used.
Thank you.
So, as you know, the Department of Human Services serves some of Minnesota's neediest citizens. We have come to understand in our work that in order to achieve effective outcomes, we have to have a continuum of services that are integrated enough to address the multidimensional needs of the families who come to us. And we can't do it alone. It takes all institutions and communities working together to really roll back childhood poverty, abuse, neglect, and homelessness. It's also important to note that these systemic issues are not present for all of our clients. Many of our clients come to us and participate in our programs for a short period of time and then leave, but others are there much longer. If I could leave you with one message today about the people we serve, it would be that we serve complex individuals who are in complex families with complex and multidimensional needs. These are not easy fixes by any means. The complex families that come to us are individuals who come from broken families. They're individuals who've grown up and live in poverty. They are individuals and families who have people with significant behavioral and mental health disorders. They are both children and adults who've lived with and experienced adverse and traumatic childhood experiences that stay with them throughout their life. And of course, we have people who have grown up and experienced racism and discrimination throughout their life. I'll talk more about that. What I want to do now is just give you a sense of the impact and the numbers of people that we serve in our programs. As you can see, our programs impact hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans, especially poor children. We also serve adults who receive housing and income supports. These are generally adults who have some sort of disability or inability to work. As you can see, we also serve respond to about 25,000 children who are reported to be at risk of abuse or neglect in a year, and about 11,000 children in any year experience out-of-home placement, which in and of itself is a traumatic experience, although necessary in certain instances. One of the things that you have seen and heard a lot about is also the number of special needs children who have been in foster care and who experience adoption. And that number continues to rise. We have now almost 7,000 children on our adoption assistance program because of the work that you have done to make sure that adoptive families have resources to help meet the needs of special needs children whom they adopt.
Senator Benson has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Sullivan Sutton. Under SNAP recipients, do we know how many able-bodied non-working adults are in SNAP in Minnesota?
I'm looking over to my colleagues here. I believe that the change with the able-bodied adults that became effective yesterday will impact about 42,000 individuals.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Sullivan Sutton, that's adults without children.
That's correct.
Would you describe what went in effect yesterday that you're describing?
Yeah, so during the for the past couple of years, we have had what we call a waiver in which able-bodied adults who are on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program were not required to participate in the work or preparing for work activities, and that was because of the economy and the job situation. In the past, people who are considered able-bodied would only be eligible to be on the SNAP program for 3 months out of 36 months, so 3 months in a three-year period if they were not working or participating in work activities. So the waiver allowed for individuals that were able-bodied to continue to receive SNAP every month, regardless of whether they were participating in those work activities. The waiver ended yesterday. So people now who are able-bodied have to be involved in work activities for 80 hours a month, and that means either working or engaging in activities that would help them become employed in order to receive the SNAP benefit on a monthly basis. If they don't meet those requirements, then they could only be eligible for 3 months out of 36 months.
Okay, thank you.
So as you know, we deal with people who are living in extreme poverty. And about 12% of all Minnesotans live in poverty, but over 15% of the children in our state are in poverty. Children are especially vulnerable in tough economic times, and for many that we serve, the tough times continue with low-paying jobs, part-time jobs, and few benefits-paying jobs available for people with little post-secondary education. And that's one of the challenges that we have with people that we serve is the level of education of the parents. The numbers of African-American and American Indian children, as you know, in poverty are much higher than other children. Poverty has significant effects on children. One of the major longitudinal studies show that children growing up in poverty completed less schooling, earned half as much money as adults. When they were adults, they worked fewer hours, and they were more likely to experience health issues as adults. And one of the things that we see is the intergenerational poverty, and we see generations of people on our programs that we're trying to address. One of the things that it's important to note is that a third of the children we serve in the Minnesota Family Investment Program are under the age of five, and 70% of the people on that program are children. So we are dealing with people in extreme poverty on a regular basis. The other thing that we know about children in poverty is they're more likely to experience trauma in their lives, and one of the things that we have seen is trauma impacts the development of children well into adulthood. One of the things I think you may have heard about in the past year in particular is what we call the ACEs study that was published by the Department of Health. And what this study was a study of individuals who had reported to have experienced adverse childhood experiences as a child. So these are adults who report that they've had experienced physical abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, mental illness of a household member, a growing up with a parent who abused chemicals or alcohol, a household member who experienced divorce or separation, domestic violence. So what we saw is that many people experienced one or more ACEs, as we say, in their lives. And what we see is in our programs, we have individuals who experience childhood with a number of ACEs and experience and trauma that has influenced who they are as in their development. And we see individuals who've experienced a single traumatic event, individuals or children who have grown up with chronic trauma, and individuals who experience a lot of complex trauma, which means that they're exposed to trauma every day in their lives. And the effects of trauma depends on the age. One of the things that we know is that trauma changes the development of children's brains, which is very important. Trauma creates toxic stress in the lives of individuals that we serve, and that the negative effects of trauma cascade over time, and it really influences what people's experiences are in terms of their life experiences, including school performance, their experience with violence, both as victims of violence as well as perpetrators of violence. We know that children who've experienced a lot of trauma in their lives are disproportionately represented in the juvenile justice system as well as in the mental health system. And this is important to know as we look at what are the responses that we have to people who come to our system oftentimes as a result of their life experiences. We are paying very close attention in our work, especially now as more evidence has become available in terms of how trauma and various kinds of impacts of trauma impact many of the families we serve. We're really trying to look at how the interaction of service delivery responds in a way that recognizes trauma and really responds to helping people deal with the trauma that they have experienced. One of the important things to note in all of this is also how behavioral mental health affect our populations. About 51% of the parents who come to our Minnesota Family Investment Program have had a mental health diagnosis within the past 3 years. And in our group residential housing program, which is mostly available for single adults with disabilities, is almost 70% of those individuals have a mental health diagnosis. almost 70% of the reports that come in to our child protection system.
May I ask on that?
Sure.
On the group residential housing, the 68% with mental health diagnosis, is that the disability or is that on top of another disability? A physical disability.
It may be on top of another disability. So people who are in group residential housing are eligible for general assistance, generally based on a number of criteria. Many of them will have mental health as the disability. Others will have substance abuse as a disability or else some physical disability as well. So Dave Hartford, who's going to follow me today, will talk about some of the treatment methodologies and the direction that we're going with respect to addressing behavioral and mental health issues. But I thought it was important for you to see how prevalent these issues are for the people who come to access income assistance or child welfare services in our programs. One of the other issues that we see we talked about earlier is the significant disparities in Minnesota. As I mentioned earlier, disparities in Minnesota for people of color are significant in the state of Minnesota, and I think across the board the disparities for people of color in Minnesota are probably worse than they are in any other state in the country.
Would you say that again?
I think the disparities, from what I know, the disparities for people of color in our state are worse than any other state in the country. And I think that's true for any indicator that you take a look at, whether it's people in poverty, the health disparities, children in out-of-home placement, across the board. I mean, those are all, I think, systemic indicators of how people of color fare in the state. And while Minnesota is oftentimes ranked as one of the best states for the well-being of children, for example, that's very true, except for children of color in our state. And that's a significant challenge for us to address. Disparities for African American and American Indian in Minnesota
are particularly
problematic.
Senator Hayden, I saw that you had – would you want to ask a question at this time?
Yeah, well, thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Sullivan-Sutton. Thank you for being here. Do you know why? Why are we worse than all of these why is the gap so large for people of color in this state, or why do we lead the country in disparity?
Senator, I don't know. And that, I think, is one of the most troubling things, is because we take great pride in how well people in our state do, and yet for certain people, we don't do well at all. And that's very troubling. And I think that's a challenge for all of us, that we should be alarmed at how some children and families in our state are faring.
But that was the question earlier. What are the analytics telling us as to what's driving this outcome that we do not like and want to change? And without an understanding of that, it's hard to determine where and how to direct resources for change. Senator Benson, I just want to check. Did you have a question at this time, too?
No, I wanted to make sure.
Okay, Senator Hayden, go on.
Oh, well, good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say the same thing. I think it's – I mean, for me, it seems to be – I've been thinking about this a lot, as you guys well know, but I can't kind of get – in medical terms, it's like, you know, it's if you got to get to the root cause of what is happening as to why, and then you come up with the treatment that hopefully is most effective. And if we can't diagnose, if you will – what's happening, I'm not quite sure how we're going to solve it or if our treatment of this is effective, because we don't seem to know what is driving it. And so Madam Chair, I'm puzzled.
We have to highlight that, I think, right. That's what we're doing here. We're highlighting right. That. That's true. We have described, or at least you've described, a lot of contributing dynamics, toxic stress, generational right. poverty. Those are all what I would describe as environmental criteria that create this and the need for the services of the Department of Human Services.
Right. So,
but we do need, we do need together. This is not a complaint or anything, but we're highlighting, I think, the need to answer the question: how do we get an answer to our question that we need, so that when we have bills that come in front of this committee for funding, that we know that they're going to be at least directed at a solid root cause analysis, would be my terminology, too, of what's driving this problem. And then of those contributing factors, which ones can we truly impact through government? And where can we get the best bang for our buck in terms of changing that marker?
Right. So we know that the poverty rates are highest among African-American. And African-Americans, 37.8% of African-Americans in our state are in poverty, by definition. We also know that African-Americans have the highest unemployment rate in our state. Women who are single parents are 76% more likely to be unemployed than the general population. We also struggle with rates of teen pregnancy in our population. Particularly, the rates of teen pregnancy are greatest among American Indian, but they're also significant within the African American population.
It would be really great if, Senator Hayden has asked for, and I agree that if we could really spend some time having this very specific conversation around disparities, where we really try to lay out what, or you and your department would, and then come back and say, here's what we're looking at. Here's the data, to help us see what it is that we need to impact. Senator Hayden.
So, Madam Chair, if I may add, I got kind of two kind of specific ask, I guess. Is one just a little easier? I know that when I used to work in this, there was a lot of data that showed that this population also had a lot of sexual abuse. A high number of people in the infant population over certain times. So if we could kind of tease some of that out, I think that falls into the trauma. But I think that's a special kind of trauma. I don't know how to describe it, but that I think really has an impact on people's lives. So I think if we could do that. The other thing I'd like to see, Ms. Sullivan Sutton, is where are we spending our dollars and who are we spending our dollars with as part of the analysis? Because what I'm starting to question is that we, Madam Chair, Ms. Sullivan Sutton, we spend a lot of money trying to deal with these issues. Us as a department, you as a department, and then us contracting out to nonprofit organizations and third parties and others, to vendors to deal with this. I'd like to get some analysis of where those dollars are going and then what the effectiveness of those organizations are that are working with this population. Maybe we have to get to the root cause in a different way by just trying to figure out what are we doing and what's working and what's not working. I think that would be helpful as well.
I think Senator Hayden has raised this issue in a variety of places. I think it's really worth our time, and we can talk about what you need in order to accomplish that. Would you let us know so that we're supportive of this effort? When we were talking about the grants that are being distributed for helping communities get access to health coverage through the Minnesota Insurance Exchange, this issue was raised also. We're sending money maybe through traditional systems, and traditional systems traditionally do not, for some reason, have the capacity to change this benchmark. So that's part of this analysis, is maybe to acknowledge that we are have great goals, great ideals, but we're just constantly channeling money through a system that's not impacting this. So we really need to dig into and understand this.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And one of the things that we're continuing to learn and to look at is, while we can't change all the disparities in our state, we have a responsibility to try to have our programs meet the disparate needs of people that come to our attention and respond much more in a culturally responsive way. Sometimes that means by providing services by culturally specific organizations, but even if that's not the case, we need to respond and respect the culture that people bring to us, as we have in our services. And I think that's one of the things.
Assistant Commissioner, may I just you're just striking me on a policy question here. So I don't know if you've said this, but I'm inferring a little bit from what you're saying. I'm not meaning that you're inferring this, but I'm drawing from what you're saying that your department is serving this population. So you need to be culturally sensitive in your service delivery system. But the questions of the upstream questions about the analysis and the interventions that will prevent this multi-generation disparities issue is not necessarily work that your division is going to do. We may need to have that conversation with the health department, prevention, seeing violence, seeing health disparities as a public health a failure to implement a public health program, which prevents the development of the program. I'm inferring that somehow from what you're saying. What would you respond to what I'm saying?
I think that's correct. And let me step to give you an example. So what this chart shows is the number of children in out-of-home placement by population. And what you see here, so we've been tracking to the far left, I guess, is 2003 data going to 2012. And so we've been tracking the rate of placement per thousand for different populations of kids in our state. The green line is African-American children. And so what we have seen is we've been able to reduce the out-of-home placement of African-American children in our state from 43 per thousand to 24 per thousand. So that's moving in the right direction. The top line is American Indian children. And you see a little uptake in the last year, and that primarily is attributable to some improved reporting by Beltrami County, frankly. But the big issue is there still continues to be a significant disparity in the rate of out-of-home placement with Indian children. What I can tell you is that in our child welfare system, we have worked very hard over the course of the last decade to really look at how we're responding to families who are reported for abuse and neglect, oftentimes for reasons of poverty. And many of you have heard me talk about this before, but we had a system in the past where people who were reported for abuse and neglect, the system or the government went out to the homes, oftentimes unannounced, knocking on somebody's door, and asked two questions. One, did you maltreat your kid? And two, were services needed? Well, by asking the first question, did you maltreat your child, it's a very important question. But you started out that relationship between the government agency and that family as an adversarial relationship, and it was a gotcha. And so we worked very hard in our state to change the nature of that relationship, recognizing that, yes, there are some people who do awful things to children, but most of the people who are reported to Child Protection are reported oftentimes for basic needs issues and for reasons of neglect, sometimes chronic neglect, but sometimes it's because they can't meet the children's needs because of poverty. And so we changed the hypothesis about the people who are coming to our door and also changed the way that we viewed and talked to those individuals. So we really changed our practice system to not focus on whether you maltreated your child in most cases, but really, how are you doing taking care of your children? Do you need help taking care of your children? Do you need some services that would help you do even better? And by changing the nature of that relationship, we saw families avail themselves of services where they would not in the past, particularly if the government was knocking at their door with the threat of taking their children away.
You know, I think this is a fabulous it also is responding to my fundamental question, which is that it's not just one department or another. There are things that you're doing in terms of the service delivery itself, the way in which you're interacting with a culture or with a group that can impact this grid. I think that's fabulous. Senator Benson.
Actually, Madam Chair, we've kind of gotten a little further, but as I looked at the previous chart, and there's no need to go back, you were talking about the health department and upstream. I really feel like the education department is the upstream. If you look at the top two bullet points, poverty and unemployment are intimately related to whether or not you graduate from high school. And so while that's outside the purview of this committee, we certainly have enough overlap on this committee with an education committee to understand that we can't keep doing the same thing with populations experiencing disparity and expect to have positive outcomes in the Human Services Department unless we get them graduating from high school with basic skills. And so I'm all in for the conversation, but let's take a bigger look at what's happening in these families.
Yeah, I think that I was trying to highlight the fact that you are a service. You're providing a service. You're meeting the needs of people who are in a certain condition or state. We have a goal of changing the numbers. So it's, but we don't want to abandon the service to those who are in this condition now. So it's not like we aren't going to continue to need to understand what the current need is and what the support systems are now. But there's also the process of changing multiple factors, including education. Also toxic stress, you know, the brain development that makes a child capable of learning or not learning, or overwhelmed circuitry that doesn't develop properly. You know, I'm certain that Senator Claussen is fully aware of how that impacts students coming into the school system. So, yes, Senator Claussen.
I was going to make a comment earlier which relates to Senator Benson, that we also have one of the greatest achievement gaps in the nation. And many times we look at it, this is an education problem, but the roots of the problem are really grounded many times in the social issues that we need to address. And I sometimes think, again, we talked about silos. I think we need to work together and look at this. I was in drug court with observing here last week, and one of the questions I asked in the pre-trial conversations is the education level of the people that were being served. Many times they lacked a high school diploma or gotten a GED, but they needed further training to really benefit their family and themselves. So I agree, education is a big issue here that needs to be a partner in all of the social issues that we're dealing with.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about education. I'm not thinking K-12 education. I'm only. Mm-hmm. This boundary violations that Senator Hayden was talking about in terms of sexual boundary violations or psychological boundary violations or just space violations that occur in a homeless shelter, and the toxic stress in the developmental years that families are dealing with.
Right, and we're
our pre-kindergarten, you know, so there's many places upstream that relate to what we're talking about here in order for us to truly be able to change the trajectory that we're talking about in some of these markers. Senator Benson is next, and then Senator Hayden.
Sorry, again, I'm a little far afield, but having sat on the Oversight Committee with Senator Sharon and Senator Hayden, when the grants completely missed an entire ethnic group, instead of going in and changing the process and saying, what did we mess up? They pasted something on top of it and pretended they fixed the problem. And if that's happening regularly, then we will never solve this problem. And I think that's a little bit of what Senator Hayden was getting at. If we're missing populations, treating them culturally appropriately is important. But if the system that everybody's being pushed through is not effective, simply treating them culturally appropriately at the end is never going to solve the problem. If we have a systemic problem, let's figure it out and fix it, and then treat them culturally appropriately, obviously. But we can't keep pasting things on the end and thinking we're solving a problem. We have to measure inputs and outcomes. And I don't know exactly what that looks like, but we're making a little progress here, but we're still missing some key people that aren't getting what they need early enough.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senator Benson's kind of driving down on what I'm thinking about as well. I mean, there's a particular group of people that we're not doing well with. So, like, you know, and We like to kind of dance around this issue of race, and I won't start, Madam Chair, a full-fledged conversation about race here, but it is what we're talking about. Often what I hear people talk about is we'll start easing into the social economics, you know, well, is it race or is it just poverty? Is it education? Well, it's race. I mean, there's the indicators all the way through show that people of color and African Americans do worse, even at the highest levels in our society, their indicators aren't as well. And if we don't kind of figure out that maybe this is not the most appropriate form, and I don't want to take up your time, but if we don't kind of explore that aspect of it and who we are without being defensive and thinking that because we ask about race that I'm calling you racist, which is exactly not what I'm doing, but that it's showing up everywhere we go. It is race. Something is happening in our state that is not taking a good look at, I don't know if it's culturally specific, if it's, you know, I don't know. I mean, I have some ideas, but there is something going on relative to race. And I think that the denial that we have about, the denial that we have and not talking about it is keeping us in the same place. But with that being said, Ms. Sullivan, I do want to say that you have done a pretty good job on this out-of-home placement. So what I'd like to know, maybe not today, but as we explore this conversation, what did you guys do? And you talked a little bit about it, but you probably did a lot more than what you're saying, and we're giving you an opportunity to talk about. What was the relationship, and how did the relationship change with this particular population that got you to lower those out-of-home placement rates? I think that is important. But, Madam Chair, if we don't get pretty serious in talking about on every single front, education, healthcare access, social service, I mean, we got this Department of Transportation issue where we've never met the goals there, and what we did do, we fudged, at least that's the report coming out. If we don't really talk about that and be honest with each other, then I think we'll be having this conversation long after Senator Benson and the rest of us are gone from this legislature.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, we'd be happy to talk to you more about this. But in a nutshell, this was a multi-year effort. It really was about engaging with people differently, respecting who people are, and treating the adults and parents as partners, and recognizing that the well-being of children is dependent on the well-being of their families. And I think one of the things that we're looking at, or that I'm looking at, is how can we take what we've learned from some of the research that was done in that process and apply it to other areas of the department. I also want to go back and talk a little bit about the comments with respect to education, because I think those are very important. And one of the things that I think it's important to know is that we are trying to work very closely across departments, including the Department of Health, Education, as well as Human Services, to take a look at what opportunities there are for children, for all children, but particularly children in poverty, to have quality early childhood experiences. And you did some work in your committee to address some child care rate issues to help children in poverty have access to high quality care. The Education Committee passed legislation with respect to scholarships. And those scholarships that are being distributed by the Department of Education are focused on children in poverty, and it really is across all of the agencies trying to raise the bar to make sure children in poverty in particular have access to high-quality care so they, in fact, are coming to kindergarten prepared to learn and prepared to succeed in education. And I think that's one of the things that across state government and as well as the legislature is recognizing.
I think we'll need to continue on with your presentation, but I just want to highlight this interactive conversation, because what I'm hearing from our members here in their dialogue is concern about these disparities, and that the analysis of that means that in the same way that the distribution of grants for InMinsure needs not to be simply doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome with more money, but really going down and taking a look at institutional racism in the decision-making process for how resources are distributed, or even how we think about the distribution of those resources. And that our language, when we talk health disparities, but we take a look about, well, who are we talking about? We're talking about American Indians and African Americans. You know, but we don't say that. We say poverty and do-do-do-do-do. And what, and it glosses over that we are the worst state in the nation in terms of disparities across all sorts of measures. For Minnesota that's why I asked you to repeat it. I don't want it to be said and then just sort of go on and talk about other kinds of things. I don't think you're trying to do that. But I think that members of our committee are very interested in using the language that creates the agitation that is necessary to expose the reality that is necessary for us to really pay attention to and make changes in this terrible measure of our state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I want to point out that you have done that I think is a good example of at least starting to move in some direction. So several years ago, you provided funds and legislation to allow for two of our Indian tribes to take over the delivery of child welfare services. So you transferred responsibility for child welfare to the White Earth Nation as well as to the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. And what I can tell you is that the outcomes for those projects or programs are very positive. And I think what we have seen is that individuals who are experiencing services from the band that they're members of, it's been a positive experience. And I think one of the things that we were looking at is, could we see different outcomes and different experiences for people if we had a different way of serving them? Recently, you also transferred responsibility for all of human services to the from Monoman County and to be followed by Clearwater and Becker County to the White Earth Nation. And the White Earth Nation has for a long, long time, has had a strong infrastructure of health and human services and a strong desire to serve all of the people in their on their reservation. And I think that's a movement. And we're working with them and the counties right now to transfer those services to the White Earth Nation. So this is just another, I'm going to go through this really quickly. So this emphasizes the disparities that we see in our Minnesota Family Investment Program. There's been a persistent gap between the outcomes for white Minnesota Family Investment participants and African-American and American Indian participants. And this graph is pretty complicated, but it's one of the things to see is that the red and yellow lines are the African and American and American Indian individuals. And as you can see, those bars are much lower than the others. And so that's something that we need to continue to work on, is how do we serve those individuals in a different way that produces different outcomes. And you did provide some funding to help us look at some pilot projects to do that in the years to come. So one of the things that you asked us to talk about is, how do we know if what we're doing is working or not? And so we have, we look at a lot at outcome measures, and we have a lot of outcome measures in some areas and fewer in other areas. But I just wanted to, for illustrative purposes this morning, is to talk to you about a couple of things that we're doing and measuring. So I mentioned the redesign of our child welfare system. And we look at a number. We have actually about 23 different measures, I think, that we look at in that area. But one of the things that we have done in redesigning our child welfare system is also moving to have early intervention so that we help families who might be at risk of maltreatment but are not kind of bad enough on that day that report is made to the county agency to make an offer of service and an offer of assistance to them. And you actually funded a statewide movement in that direction with the Parent Support Outreach Program. And what we saw with those early intervention efforts is if families are identified and offered services, they avail themselves of those services. And, in fact, 80% of the families who were in an early intervention pilot said that they were better off or much better off for having had the assistance of the county agency. So we can learn from that. We're also looking to improve access to services. So one of the things that we're measuring is the percentage of children in our child care assistance program who have a child care subsidy who are in quality child care arrangements. So we're looking at the number of kids and whether we're being able to increase the number of poor kids in high-quality care. And again, that's very important because it makes a difference in terms of kids being ready for school, and that's something that we need to track. We also want to measure how long it takes for people who are in need of assistance and eligible for assistance, how long does it take for them to actually apply and get on our cash and food programs. That's really important, and that's something that we measure over time. And we really want to, we work with our counties on an individual basis as well as a collective basis to say these are important things. If we have people who are in need of food assistance immediately, they need to have access to that in a timely way. We also want to ensure stability for families, so we track child support payments. We have a number of measures in the child support area, but one of them is we track how the percentage of current child support that is due, how much of that is paid. We also look at how many families in 3 years leave public assistance because they are getting child support. We track things like establishment of paternity to make sure that resources are available to care for children in our care.
And what have you discovered about the relationship between our efforts to get and collect child support and relief to the state that comes from that for being on public programs? Can you, in a general way, say that, you know, we're making an investment in order to make child support payments be paid to the family member.
Right.
And so there's a cost associated with that. So we always have to ask, is the effort and the cost of the effort, besides meeting one objective, which would be to hold people responsible for their children, but the other is that if that person is responsible and participates in the payments for their child, then the general taxpayer doesn't have to fill in for that responsibility. Are you showing that this investment that we're making here is paying off in terms of at least equivalent, if not some relief in terms of the burden on this taxpayer?
So I'm looking to Jeff Jorgensen, who's our child support director. I think the answer to that is yes. We do fairly well in our performance across a number of items in the child support area. Where we're less effective is in the administration of the child support program. And so that's one of the issues that we're struggling with, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you about in the future. Is it cost us, the administrative cost for collecting child support is pretty significant in our state, and I don't know if that's because we're county administered or what the issue is. But we do a good job of identifying fathers and establishing child support and collecting child support. I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that. Okay.
We also track the number of families that are on public assistance, and there is a correlation to those that are receiving child support than do go off public assistance faster.
So what Mr. Jorgensen just said for the record.
Yeah, we need to say it for the record.
For the record
we
is
should
that
have
we,
people come to the table if they're going to
feel
be speaking.
Feel free to come up, Jeff. We are tracking the number of child support collections for people on public assistance and those individuals who leave public assistance that are getting child support.
I got a question.
Yes, Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Jorgensen. Where does the dollars, so when you, if you have a person on public assistance and you are collecting child support, those dollars go directly to the custodial parent or the, what do we call it now, we changed the term. So,
Senator Hayden.
Say your name, please, for the record.
I'm Jeff Jorgensen from the Child Support Division. Senator Hayden, yes, we call still the custodial parent.
Okay.
And we do pass through the child support collected for families that are on public assistance. So we have 100% pass through.
So you have 100% pass through. Okay. Oh, so this
Hayden.
Is. Oh, so thank you, Madam Chair. So this is where I'm going. So for those non-custodial parents that say, wasn't paying and ended up with a bill, a debt, they're in the arrears, you often will kind of, when you finally kind of catch up with them, they'll have to kind of start paying their current support order, and then they'll have to start repaying the state. Is that right, Mr. Jorgensen?
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, that is correct.
Okay. So for those dollars that you collect that are in the arrears, where do those dollars go?
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, it does get complicated depending on what program a person is on, but generally speaking, the current child support that is collected is passed through to the family, and then those payments, the additional payments that go towards the arrears, would go to repay public assistance arrears that accrued while they were on assistance.
So if we follow that, Madam Chair, Mr. Jorgensen, so those dollars would then go back to, if they were on the MFID program, they go back to the bucket that has the MFID dollars. Is that right?
That is correct.
And then does those dollars that went back to the MFID program, do they go back to the federal government?
Mr. Jorgensen.
I'll help you with this, Mr. Jorgensen. It doesn't. It stays with us.
That we have your names on the tape, we'll need to follow that clumsy process. But I'll try to make it quick so that you can keep your rhythm going, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate that we're getting in rhythm here. I guess the question that I would have is that if we're able to track those dollars and how much of those go back to the state, maybe is there an opportunity for us, Ms. Sullivan Sutton, to reinvest those dollars into the programs that help those families? Would there be an opportunity maybe to incentivize those that aren't paying, that if they do pay, that we would help maybe cut down what they pay in arrears? And where I'm going, Madam Chair, with this is part of this issue, what I'm intrigued with in the child support world is that often those that I think part of our administrative cost that Ms. Sullivan talked about is kind of chasing down those non-custodial parents to get them to pay. Those non-custodial parents often are running around and sometimes they're just irresponsible and don't want to take care of their children, but often they were young when they were having the children, they didn't have any skills. They kind of racked up this really big bill, and by the time that they are ready to establish themselves or have established themselves, they're now faced with the current support order, which they should pay, and then this big debt to the government that simply just goes back to the general fund. So I guess my question, Ms. Sullivan Sutton, is there an opportunity for us to think about how to help to incentivize folks to pay by cutting down what they pay in arrears, or is there an opportunity to take those dollars and maybe put them into family programs that kind of help bring families together with the exception of them having to pay? I mean, you know where I'm trying to go with this.
Yes. Assistant Commissioner Sullivan Sutton, I think just to raise this to the policy discussion, have there been debates and discussions about whether this money should be going back into the general fund or dedicated towards other programs that help the specific population that's paying it?
Yes, there have. And there has also been discussions about whether there are ways to relieve the burden on non-custodial parents who have significant arrears, and are there, you know, and also are there ways that we can make sure that mostly, but not always, but mostly dads have involvement in the lives of their children regardless of the financial obligations. And certainly you as a legislature can make decisions about resources that would otherwise revert to the general fund. That's within your authority, certainly.
And is there any specific focus on this interest of Senator Hayden's at this time in the department? Are you looking at this concept of changing where these dollars go? Or is this something that Senator Hayden should pursue? Will you be bringing something in this area?
Madam Chair, and Senator Hayden, I would encourage you to pursue your interest. This is not something that we're focused on today, but it's something that has come up over time in the department, and we would be happy to help you with your research, certainly as you look at what options you might want to pursue.
So let's put this down on a list of things to do that we're trying to track here a little bit.
So, Madam Chair, with that being said, there is going to be an invitation. This is a shameless plug. for a symposium,
Senator Hayden,
on this issue, specifically looking at some of the issues about where the dollars go and what we could do, but also some of the really creative work we know that they're doing in Hennepin County, which is tying the shared parenting concept and what folks should do with the child support. And there's a program that is trying to, in a voluntary way, say once we've established paternity and established an order, we're also trying to establish the amount of time that people get to see their children, which we think is a driver for people being able to pay. And then in addition to that, looking at how do we pay for that. And I think one of the ways could be this issue of when we collect dollars in the arrears, where those dollars go. So
I think it's great. Senator Hayden, the goal of these curriculum meetings is to create an understanding of the department, its organization, its goals, what they're trying to achieve, as a basis for a discussion of something that might come forward in the next legislative session. So I'm hoping that at least at the policy committee level and maybe at the finance committee, that we will be more sophisticated in our conversations about the proposals that come in front of us, because we understand better the context out of which you are bringing a bill like that. And, of course, we would offer the opportunity for us to understand what the implications of changing that would be on other aspects of the budget. But it's just right on in terms of what my personal goal is and what Senator Claussen's goal is to really get us grounded better so that we can have a smarter discussion about these proposals when they come forward during the session.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, on that note, I want to also mention, you may be referring to this work in Hennepin County, but one of the things that you may want to look at is the co-parenting court that is occurring in Hennepin County, where they really have structured a court system to work with both parents, oftentimes very young parents, to recognize that they both individuals have responsibilities to the child, and even if they can't get along as adults, they have a responsibility to co-parent together, and they've done a really good job of working with parents and developing a plan on how they will work together to be co-parents of the children in their care. And we believe that that has a lot of promise for improving outcomes for children who might otherwise have difficult family circumstances.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay, great. Senator Claussen, you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just picking up on Senator Hayden's thoughts, I'm wondering about using some of those funds for grants to families to invest back in the families, like having reading materials in the family for children to read, giving them opportunities that middle-class families may have to go to the Minnesota Zoo, to go to the Science Museum for children. So we designate dollars to invest in opportunities for those children to have experiences, because, again, it's generational. If we're trying to break that generation, let's look at opportunities that middle-class families have for their children, that maybe these dollars could be providing those same opportunities for these people.
I think that this will be a lively. Senator Wicklund has a question.
Oh, and it's not related to child support. It's related to child care. I don't know.
Okay, so let's we'll hold that for a second and try to close this section. Obviously, when Senator Hayden finds a little pot of money that he might want to redirect, we're going to have a lot of ideas for how to spend it. I might even come up with one. Thank you very much. Senator Wicklund, on a different subject.
Yeah, a different topic. You were mentioning that you're looking at percentage of children that are accessing quality child care. And I just wondered, do you have any way to address whether, capacity of more children to be in the quality child care versus, is there enough or is there not enough available if there were, a way to get more children into it? Do you look at that at all, or is it more just, here's the percentage of children who are receiving the subsidies and they're in the high quality settings? Does that make sense?
It does, Senator Wicklund. And in fact, we are moving what we call Parent Aware, which is a quality rating system for our early childhood programs, child care, Head Start, other sorts of early childhood opportunities. It's a 4-star rating system, and we're rolling that out statewide over the next couple of years. So we are looking at it. We monitor and track how many programs are part of that quality rating system. And I'm pleased to report that I think it was about 2 weeks ago, we hit 1,000. We need many more. So we continue to track that. One of the things that we, and that's part of the state's Race to the Top grant application from the federal government, we are doing fairly well across program areas. With the exception of family child care, we're still having some challenges getting family child care providers to sign up, but we're looking at what we can do to encourage more of that, because that's very important, having the capacity. And then the other issue that we are struggling with, and I think you struggle with as well, is the child care rates and what the dollar amount is that people are eligible for when they're on child care assistance, and whether that pays what child care charges in terms of quality care. That's an issue.
Great. Now, we have about maybe 15 minutes left for this segment. Is that enough time for you to get where you need to go without us interrupting you all the time? Or can we continue to interrupt you?
You can feel free to interrupt me. I have two slides left that I will go through quickly. What I wanted to share with you is a little bit about the funding for Children and Family Services. So the first slide that I want to show you is the general fund appropriations that you provide for the Children and Family Services area of the department. So the general fund in Children and Family Services is about 10% of the total Department of Human Services general fund spending. It is about $1.1 billion. And it's hard to see the largest piece of the pie there. On the right is group residential housing. And followed by the red on the bottom is the Minnesota Family Investment Program, followed by child care in the green and general assistance. And then the teal kind of on the upper left is Children's Services, Community Services Grants. And you can see more detail on the pages that you have.
And then the next.
May I ask you just a quick question? On the group residential housing, how much of that, in terms of funding streams, just really quickly, how much is Minnesota, how much is other sources?
Group residential housing is totally general fund spending.
Okay. And MFIP is?
Combination of federal and state.
Is that 50-50? Do you know? It's about.
This slide is 100% general fund.
Oh, this one is 100%.
This is
the general fund portion.
Okay. This is a program that has a federal match.
Yes. And the next slide will show that.
Okay, great. Continue
so this
then.
This is all general fund. This
Madam
slide.
Chair.
Yes, Senator Hayden.
Ms. Sullivan, can you, are you going to show us what the dollar amounts of that is? We're showing the percentages, but do we?
So one of the packets that you have, one of the things that you have in your packet is kind of a takeaway that you got last week, and the actual dollar amounts will be in that packet.
So it's the second packet in our materials.
Yes. And if you need more detail than that, just let us know. And then this slide is the all funds picture of the funding in Children and Family Services. And this is about 12% of all of the department spending, which totals $3.4 billion of all funds. And you can see the breakdown there. So this is the total spending.
So I can draw from that about $2.3 billion comes from other sources other than the general fund.
That's correct.
And of those dollars that come from other sources, are they going to affect housing access? But, I mean, with the changes at the federal level in terms of funding or even access to funding for housing, are these housing programs threatened? This is all funds. So what happens with those programs here that are dependent on federal funds when federal funds are either reduced or simply frozen?
I scratched my head, Senator. It's kind of a hard question to answer. So there are When it comes to
housing. Can you talk in the microphone? I guess they're having trouble picking
up. When it comes to housing, there are about 23 different programs across the Department of Human Services that have to do with housing. Group residential is one of them. There are also grants that we provide to community organizations that provide, you know, supportive housing, transitional housing. There are also housing services that are directed at disabled populations in the chemical and mental health area. So what I will say is that anytime federal funds are reduced or frozen, it impacts our ability to serve. If there's fewer resources available. Now, I don't know if you're getting at what's happening now with respect to the federal shutdown. We are watching things very closely. We don't expect any benefits to our clients to change, at least during the month of October, as a result of what's happening there.
I guess it's not really part of the orientation, but I am concerned about that we're aware of what the consequence of this will be on just an essential need for shelter for people. And are we aware of what that possibility is and have any strategy at all for how to not simply have people without basic shelter? So you probably can't answer that right now.
Madam Chair, I know
October's good, but
October's good. It's something that we and other state agencies are watching very closely. I would expect that the Housing Finance Agency is also paying very close attention to this because all of us are very concerned about the impact to people in our state.
Yeah. Senator Clausen.
Yep, Madam Chair, thank you. Can you give us a rough idea of that $3.4 billion? How much of that is federal?
Yeah, that's going to be too old. We know that $1.1 billion is general fund.
Is general fund.
So there's $2.3 that's some other revenue streams. Is there something other than federal money there?
There may be. Most of it would be federal funds. There's some smaller, you know, there may be private funds in there, but most of it is federal funds.
Okay.
And in Children and Family Services, we're, you know, as you can see, we're heavily reliant on federal funds for the services that we provide.
Is there another question here before? Is there anything else in this area? Thank you so much. This was really very, very good. For me, and I hope for others as well, is there anything else in this area that people have an interest in that we might pick up in the future? Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'm not answering your question, but one of the things that I wanted to say is that the comments made by yourself and by Senator Hayden really hit home with me. We have been reporting on correlations constantly, correlations, and that may not be what we need to report on to go forward. What we need to do is we need to find cause and effect, and I think what Senator Hayden was asking for is why. Why is this happening? And that's cause and effect, and I think we can't let up our drive to continue to find that cause and effect. And you know, we talk about the education gap. We talk about the health care gap. We talk about all of these gaps that we have. And I think that they probably have pretty much the same answer. And it's larger than one department in the state. And I think that's what we need to do is we need to just vigorously go after the cause and effect here. And I think, in actuality, I'll make the statement that I don't think we understand race yet. I don't think we understand it. And I think that it has a major impact, and it might be there might be a lot of very serious questions we need to ask ourselves about our history here in Minnesota and where this cause and effect starts to have a race relationship. And I guess that's what I want to say is that I'm very encouraged by where we've gone today and by the comments that I've heard, And I think what we need to do is look at that with some very, very serious questions.
I appreciate that. I think that one of the things, the goal of this, of course, is orientation and sort of highlighting as a basis for future discussion and policy discussion in committee that should be serious, too. I hope we achieve that goal. Rather than everybody being positioned before they show up to a meeting, you know, I'd like to really have the meeting have some purposeful conversation in it. But what I'm anxious about now that I hadn't planned for in this meeting, other than when Senator Hayden was talking about some of his goals, that he's some of the things he's thinking about for proposals in the next session, that this what I would think of is we should be looking at institutional racism in our decision-making process that creates the outcome of not being able to change that marker, that we don't lose that it's on a list of things that we will go back to and be deliberate about going after, rather than this circle of constantly bringing up problems and not moving the dime on them, just sort of enjoying its description is what the way I talk about it. We just describe, and we don't move forward in a problem-solving process. Do the second-level assessment, which this is healthcare talk now, nursing talk really. Second-level assessment is root cause analysis. What are the contributing factors? You cause it, cause. What is cause? Contributing factors. Analyzing those contributing factors for where you can invest resources and get the biggest outcome, because there'll be multiple contributing factors. And then making those investments and measuring whether or not they in fact change that. But underlying all of this, and I think Senator Hayden keeps bringing us back to that, is in the process of even doing root cause analysis, you can have institutional racism going on so that you can't get your analysis correct. And if you don't get the analysis correct, the markers don't change. And so I think we have to be very, very deliberate about thinking how we are going to change this horrific misinformation you highlighted for us today about where we stand in health disparities for those two groups. So I think unless there's anything else anybody else wants to say on this subject, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time. If you want to know any more about any of our programs, feel free to contact Nikki Farrago, and we're happy to meet with any of you.
All right, now we are going to hear we're going to start our orientation to chemical and mental health services. Here with us today is Dave Hartford, who is the Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health Services in the Department of Human Services. And you have someone else with you that I'll have you introduce. And just a reminder that we want to say people's names. So when you speak, if you just reorient the tape to who's speaking. Well, I guess you're just setting up the technology, but okay, great. Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Hartford.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. I'm Dave Hartford. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for DHS Chemical and Mental Health Services, which is one of the four program areas within the Department of Human Services, along with continuing care, health care, and children's services.
So if we're going to look on the organizational graph that the commissioner gave us, this will be a new division that we're starting to dig into to understand.
Yes, out of the four that are actually program areas, one of the four program areas. I thought I would start with just within the Chemical and Mental Health Division vision statement. You're familiar. I just passed by the DHS vision statement. I'll move right on to the Chemical and Mental Health Services. This was really adapted from the Comprehensive Mental Health Act that was passed back in 87 and really adapted to our purposes today, if you will, harkens back to those involved then with the Mental Health Action Group and a lot of the work that was done laying some foundations. And the only thing I wanted to really point out and highlight in this one is about the grounded in public-private partnerships, that in this area of behavioral health services, I'm using that in the broadest sense in that we work with a variety of agencies in order to get the work done in this area. We work closely with a number of other state agencies, as reflected in our statewide substance abuse strategy, Children's Cabinet, the governor's homelessness initiative. So across state agencies, within our other agencies within DHS, more and more as we look at healthcare reform, we work with healthcare, continuing care, because all of these divisions are having to work together much more closely today in order to accomplish the work, as well as our advocacy communities, Mental Health Association, NAMI, we work closely with those groups, provider organizations. So just to kind of highlight that a lot of the work that the agency does is convening and working with a lot of the other stakeholder groups. The really core piece of what we do, though, is we shape, develop, and monitor our service areas, policies, and financing. I mean, that's kind of the core of the job. We're about 90 FTEs of clinicians, experts in a variety of topic areas that work closely, provide technical assistance across the state in many areas. We do a great deal of convening, if you will, of stakeholder groups in a variety of different ways in order to accomplish that shaping and development of policy consideration. We also do monitoring. And I just wanted to point out the other part of our mission piece there is the triple aim. And for those of you familiar with that, that was really evolved from the Institute of Healthcare Improvement as a grounding, if you will, for healthcare, as to change the improve consumer experience, health of population, reduce the cost. That whatever we do, we try to look at things from all three of those aspects. Again, inside the division, we've got the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, which is the single state authority in the state of Minnesota, both through state statute and also federally, the connection to the state, to the federal government through SAMHSA, the Centers for Substance Abuse and Mental Health, and also contained in the, we've contained the Adult Mental Health Division and the Children's Mental Health Division, where the state authority for mental health also resides, which is the relationship again to the federal government.
Would you, and I'm just not exactly clear. You said the single authority for chemical dependency. What? Tell us what that means. You're the single authority for chemical dependency and for mental health services. What does the single authority mean?
That means it's really the contact. As for instance, the block grant, the federal block grant, which channel goes through those two authorities back to the federal government and really directs the planning, is designated as the planning agency and monitoring agency for those topics.
Okay.
And I'd like to make the point today that these jobs just got a whole lot bigger than they were just a few years ago. And what I mean by that is these services have gone along for many years, and just in the last few years, we're seeing kind of the confluence, if you will, of some major changes taking place. One of them, the obvious piece, healthcare reform is bringing in a whole array of new tools to be available. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid and SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Authority from the federal government, are clearly sending new signals to us around the future of behavioral health. And certainly everyone here has heard of the need to bring behavioral health into healthcare in some new ways. The other thing that's occurring is Minnesota is preparing the Minnesota Olmstead Plan, another huge movement, if you will, in the area of behavioral health and areas of disabilities. You also have coming into play parity. The concepts of parity are really coming into play for the first time. I mean, I think there's a lot of assumption we've had this like it's been around for a while. The fact is the Wellstone-Domenici Act is still, the final rules still aren't even out. So a lot of these concepts all of a sudden are all coming together that gives that will give us the ability, some of the ability to really change some of the systems that we have. And before I go on and talk about some of the specific policy pieces, I wanted to point out what I think is one of the biggest challenges that we have today. And if you look at the history of these services, not very long ago, and I'll talk, in 1955, we had more than 14,000 people in institutions in this state. Likewise, in the area of substance abuse, before that time, there was no treatment. So over the last number of years, there's a reason we talk about needing to integrate behavioral health, because it's clearly not part of healthcare. And I think for the first time, our science has advanced to the point that we clearly know that these are healthcare issues, that there are good outcomes that can be established. But some of the very systems that we've put in place, and we've done a good job in Minnesota in many ways, but some of the systems we've put in place actually may start to look like barriers to actually getting these services fully into healthcare. And let me give you a few examples of this, because as I observe, you start to talk about dramatic change, and if to have a vision of actually having mental health and substance abuse fully part of healthcare as any other condition, if you can imagine a world like that, many things need to change dramatically from where we are today to get there. And I'll point out a couple of pieces. Senator Marty's bill last session put forward a bill around schizoaffective disorder because it was, again, to protect populations, because over time diagnoses had evolved, so there was a whole group not covered and unable to access. And I would ask the committee, when was the last time the committee took on a cardiac diagnosis to determine if somebody could access a particular procedure? It just doesn't exist. When was the last time that you had a healthcare condition where you went to a county to determine what the treatment plan would be? These are barriers, and we did a great job in many ways of developing policies and procedures that protected these populations to get services over the last many years. But as here we are today, we've treated them as this separate track for many, many years. If you think about it, it was just a couple of years ago that Governor Pawlenty put out a proclamation apologizing for the treatment of people in this state in the institutions because of the this is not from a blame standpoint, but embedded in all of the policies and procedures that we're living with today really were grounded in this other world and not recognizing that behavioral health care is health care. And how do we get ourselves to move from where we were and move into a new world, if you will, that fully embraces behavioral health? And I had a slide here that really kind of got to the history of behavioral health services. Stigmatized, marginalized. If you look at what's the largest psychiatric facility in the country today, it's L.A. County Jail. It has more mental health diagnosed people in it today. And if you look across the nation, it's the case in many arenas. In fact, we've just seen in the papers recently stories about people stuck in the criminal justice system with mental illness and those kinds of things. So why do we care? Well, it's become very obvious that in order to move the healthcare costs or the curve in healthcare, that we need to take on this issue of behavioral health care. And because in the last number of years, a lot of studies have come forward saying, yes, a lot of the healthcare costs are driven by untreated, undiagnosed behavioral health conditions. So, and you can see by the examples here, economic cost to society, $559 billion. and around prevention. How many dollars can be saved by modest investments in prevention, and what's the return on investment? And we've talked about that in this committee in the past, but all of those investments. So the next piece, I'm going to touch very briefly on some of the very broad chemical and mental health services goals to kind of point in a direction, and I thought I could drill down into specific topic areas for the three administrations. But first, just to kind of talk broadly about goals that apply to all three areas. The first is to fill in the gaps. The current system, both for specialized and for general populations, where current services either are lacking or do not exist. And you don't have to look very far to find these. So these are specific targeted, so across the three divisions, really looking at targeted interventions that need to take place. Access, access for specific populations. During the last Aaron's presentation, talked a lot about access to services for some populations. We know is more difficult. We know we need to improve access for certain populations. Synthetic drugs is a topic that came up just this year, recognizing that we had virtually no prevention efforts around that kind of a topic. We have a recently recognized issue of lack of urgent psychiatric care. I mean, you can kind of go down the list and find specific gaps in services that we need to take on across the three areas. The next one, to facilitate the development of an integrated service delivery system that assures integrated care for behavioral and physical health challenges simultaneously. This has been talked about for many years now, and, you know, nationally, there still is not any broad-based implemented systems that have done this well and accomplished this, because this is hard. I mean, we've been talking about it. I think that we're clearly many efforts from the federal government on through is working to get this accomplished, because people recognize that it's essential. But, again, not easy, and I just kind of expert as we've, for those familiar, screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment is the evidence-based practice for substance abuse that is designed to be implemented in primary care. We've been working to implement this. It's challenging. The culture of primary care, anytime you make significant changes in practice, it comes slowly. Comes hard. And another topic in this arena is you can ask yourself, in your primary care clinic, in your clinic, what should be the capacity for that clinic to screen and to intervene on behavioral health issues? You know, if you just imagine the anxious mother of several young children, what should be the capacity? That's her place that she contacts for health care. What should be the capacity in that setting to engage appropriately, screen appropriately, refer appropriately? And the patient who suddenly their liver enzymes are starting to go up, which would indicate high levels of alcohol abuse, well, what should be the capacity, what should be the protocol within that primary care clinic to address that issue? And these are not topics that we've really taken on across the board. There are individual practitioners that practice in whatever pattern, but as far as kind of broadly not taking on those issues and that integration. Next, to shift the behavioral health service system from an acute model to a public health model by emphasizing health promotion, prevention, early intervention, care coordination at all levels. Again, this is a huge shift, and I kind of hearken back to these old systems. What did the old systems look like? Well, it was kind of a crisis-oriented system that we had inpatient work, we had institutional work, but not a lot of prevention, not a lot of continuing care. in the area of substance abuse. It was about treatment. It was about an episode of treatment. Not a lot about prevention. Not a lot about how does somebody stay supported over time. So it's trying to shift. And in order to accomplish that, we need to start to work very differently. New partners for behavioral health providers, who are the partners that you might look forward to? Like some of the work we're starting to look to, local public health as a partner within some of this, the health department, to try to look at things earlier interventions. And again, your conversation last hour, I think, was what are the root causes? How can we get ahead of some of these issues and understand how to intervene earlier? Because prevention dollars leverage much more readily than treatment dollars in an inpatient setting.
Is Assistant Commissioner, when you're talking on this particular goal, it's implied in this is, it at least comes to my mind, is a cultural understanding that, like diabetes, for example, that's the one we always use, or MS, or maybe a Crohn's disease or something, that those are chronic disease issues, maybe chronic obstructive lung disease. These are chronic diseases that have maybe escalated episodes, but then sort of a maintenance of high-level wellness. Acute episode, and then a maintenance over a long period of time of a higher level of wellness without the goal being cure. So when you talk about shifting behavioral health service from acute care model, to me, I interpret that very quickly into changing everybody's understanding that behavioral health or mental health issues or chemical dependency issues are chronic diseases, and that we've designed our healthcare delivery system to see hope and in despair, be mad at the person when they don't get well in an acute episode with a treatment, 28-day treatment model, and then they're not well. And a lot of that is aligned with an acute care model and understanding of those diseases rather than integrating them into the healthcare system and understanding that these are just another of a series of chronic diseases, some of which we can maybe prevent, just like cardiac disease or other kinds of diseases that we can affect with diet. And I mean, we talk about it in other kinds of illnesses, but suddenly on behavioral health, it becomes just a very different attitude. And I think it has to do with this understanding them, hoping that there are acute situations that can be fixed instead of understanding them as chronic disease. Would you concur mm-hmm. with that?
Madam Chair, that's exactly, I agree completely, that's the shift that, yes, in fact, Aaron Sullivan gave a presentation, talked about last hour ACEs and some of the new research about how early childhood events impact brain development, and we know that, like any other chronic disease, there are interventions earlier, and the earlier you intervene, your chances of success are much better. We know that in the area of substance abuse, that the adolescent brain is much more vulnerable to substance dependence, not just abuse, but actually developing dependence. The earlier a child uses substance, the impact on the brain is much more substantial and much higher rates of development of dependency. So all of these, the approach is to intervene early, like any other chronic disease, give appropriate care, and then monitor and maintain over time. Like you, as you were saying, diabetes, heart disease, obesity. It doesn't matter which condition, healthcare condition you talk about. The trajectory is the same in terms of early identification, appropriate treatment, and monitoring care over time, along with lifestyle change. I mean, these are all, there's no difference in the model for behavioral health. And yet we have systems that have been built on, and attitudes built on, as if these are short-term conditions, and we know that substance abuse, mental health diseases are all chronic disease conditions that tend to relapse over time.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last session, we spent quite a bit of time looking at mental health needs in the state of Minnesota, and one of the issues that was forwarded was an acute need of mental health workers at all levels in the state, so much so that we're having a summit that's going to be sponsored here in the next year of all levels of mental health workers coming together looking at how we can address this issue. Dr. Schwartz, the head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Minnesota, NAMI, others testified to this need. In looking at your goals, in fact, last week, in fact, there were seven positions that are unfilled at St. Peter because we can't find applicants, if I remember correctly from a testimony that we had. But in looking at your goals, how much of this problem with finding mental health workers is going to impact your vision for the future, the goals that you'd like to accomplish?
Madam Chair.
Assistant Commissioner.
Senator. I would say this is the topic that keeps me up most at night, because it is. This is a huge problem for us. If you look at the vision to how can we actually bring behavioral health services fully into healthcare, you need the workforce in order to accomplish that. And for a variety of reasons, we have shortages in the entire workforce, everything from peer support through psychiatry, and every job in that service delivery system, we have shortages. So I was very grateful that the summit is being held, because we need some concrete plans, and we're supporting that summit, and we need concrete plans rapidly in order to accomplish this. In the state of Minnesota, in some regards, we're in better shape than some other states, because we have always valued these services in comparison to other states, and our workforce is not as behind as others. There are some states in the area of substance abuse where because they didn't have substance abuse systems, treatment systems for public people needing public support, I've heard the figures that need to increase their workforce by 50% in order to meet the demand under health care reform in Minnesota. Ours isn't there, but it's still a huge, we have a huge shortfall here in, yes.
Thank you.
And I appreciate that. I think this workforce shortage issue is one of the barriers that you're talking about to fully integrate. One of many, and I think also using professionals, allowing professionals to practice to their full scope of practice, is and fights over that are another barrier. Unreasonable barriers are established that disallow people who could help fill these gaps from really practicing to the full extent of their care. So the workforce issue is more than numbers; it's systems that prohibit people from practicing what they could do.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I just completely agree. It's that we will need to, in order to accomplish our goals, maximize every part of our workforce and educational system in order to keep up.
Okay. Please continue.
And then the last of the four broad goals is to implement operational improvements. And a big piece here is around the outcome measures, because I would say broadly that in the area of behavioral health, we haven't done a great job of measuring the outcomes like a lot of other areas of healthcare. We've been very prescriptive on what services need to look like and monitored and licensed from that aspect, and not really been as outcome driven, if you will, to say what are the deliverables that different services should be. So we're working hard to develop a better outcome-based system of care. Now I'm going to start to drop into the different service areas, if you will. And I'm going to start with the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. story a little bit, but the same story really applies to all three divisions in that we've developed service systems in the past. Those have been evolved. They look slightly differently, but again, they were all designed over time and have opportunities to be revamped and to be re-looked at. So I'll start with the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division and start with the number one item within that, implementation of the Navigator and Model of Care Pilots, which is a piece of legislation that was just authorized last session, these Model of Care. But before I talk about this, I want to talk a little bit about that delivery system. You know, in the state of Minnesota, known as the Minnesota Model of Care for Substance Abuse, happened at Willmar State Hospital and Hazelden right here, and that's the reason, and that really prompted the national treatment movement. It was obviously we're a national leader. The other really first we had in Minnesota is the Consolidated Treatment Fund. That was a system that guaranteed access to treatment for income-eligible people. And it's still, to this day, it's one of the reasons we're in better shape today in Minnesota in our workforce, because we actually developed systems, those systems of care for treatment. Other states did not. So those were firsts. But, you know, those are quite old now. The Minnesota model, that was from the mid-50s, the consolidated fund from the 80s. Many things have changed since that time in terms of technology, treatment technology, what we know about the brain. Likewise, the funding mechanism that was established in to guarantee treatment, and it's a limited array of services available out of the consolidated fund. There's a number of different treatment. Again, this is back to the acute care model, that we have a number of acute care things to fund, and we also have medication-assisted therapy through the methadone clinics. Well, we know today that we need some additional services, that nationally we have fallen behind in terms of what services do people need that are trying to recover from substance abuse. So that's what the Model of Care report is about, is bringing up to date our service delivery system and the new tool within healthcare reform, if you will, allow some populations to be funded that weren't funded in the past. And there are other tools that can be made available through state plan amendment to be inclusive that we could add to our array. And I think the Navigator pilots that were passed a few years ago, the counties really recognize that, yes.
Could you orient us to that just a bit?
I want to say 3 years ago, 4 years ago, right in that range, the Navigator pilots, there were three pilots established. The counties wanted to spend consolidated funding dollars for some additional recovery support services for some patients because they knew that treatment services alone weren't working. They needed some care coordination, some housing, some other supports. So there were three pilots identified, and those have worked, and they've turned in good results over the last 3 years. And then last session, we really identified other services in addition to those that could be brought forward. But instead of just the Navigator pilots were designed to take money out of the consolidated fund that the county could spend the dollars that they had available, that they were contributing, and so that was the funding mechanism. The Model of Care pilots are designed to design some new services that could be part of a state plan amendment to be paid under Medicaid, to actually move the services into health care as fully funded health care services.
So they would, and they'd be paid under out of a different stream.
Out of a different stream. And again, moving away from what we have in Minnesota today for publicly funded is consolidated funding, which is a braided funding stream.
And just to take it into my language a little bit rather than department language. There is a fund that's specifically designated for the for utilization by counties for treatment of chemical dependency. There are restrictions as to what kinds of services those funds can pay for. Mostly they're the acute care old model system of 28 days of treatment or something like that. In the course of time, we've discovered that that's not enough. That's the very acute model. You're done. You go to AA and everything's done and you're supported. But we've discovered there's lots of other surround services that are needed to support, and that they may even be better than that inpatient treatment program in the first place. So these pilots have wavered, so to speak, how we've determined how those dollars can be spent. What you're talking about is that there's more of that needed, and there's an opportunity here under the Affordable Care Act to transition all of behavioral chemical dependency services into health care services and therefore paid for out of and under the same formulas that we do other health care services that are in Medicaid, Medicare.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The other feature I would add to that is the system of consolidated funding also use the counties as gatekeeper, if you will, so that instead of accessing a health care provider to get health care, it was required to receive what's referred to as a Rule 25 assessment, which is an approval through the counties in order to access care.
So are you saying to us that if we really make this transition, that it all moves over, just like any other diagnosis, into the healthcare delivery system, that the gateway becomes the healthcare provider, the healthcare home or the accountable care organization, and all of that service delivery, including the funding through the state and goes away?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay, just want to make it crystal clear what we're saying here.
But I want to be crystal clear about what I'm talking about here is an unwinding in order to get to a vision of, let's say, substance abuse services being fully part of health care, treated like any other health care condition. We're going to have to carefully, patiently unwind some of the system that we have today, because it's a little bit like fixing the bus while you're traveling, or changing the tire on the bus while you're traveling, that we have a delivery system that we're delivering services in, and yet what we're talking about is one of the things you can do, and this is what we've tended to do over time, is add on a patch here and a patch there and keep fixing. Well, at some point, do we rethink some of the mechanisms that we designed over time and really revamp them? So that's a little bit about what I'm talking about here, is taking a look at actually trying to, what are the steps to get substance abuse fully into the healthcare delivery system? What does that look like?
Well, Assistant Commissioner, I think that there might be elements that now are, because they're siloed off into county services rather than in the health and human services delivery, that the functions of the county and the state might change, and it's paid for in a different way. It's paid through healthcare dollars rather than this consolidated, separate, siloed fund of money. But there still will be, like there are in other areas, the need for these wraparound services, social services that might be provided through the counties. I mean, I don't see yet, at least, healthcare homes having full social service systems in them or full housing support service systems in them. It might be a part of the overall, you know, a person who is diagnosed and recognized to have a chemical dependency problem might, through their physician, their family physician, or their advanced practice nurse or mid-level practitioner, develop a treatment plan that includes a housing support system, but that might still be coordinated through the county, correct?
That's, Madam Chair, that's correct. And I think just from a conceptual standpoint, one of the things we've done over time because of the old systems that we had, unlike healthcare, mainstream healthcare services, behavioral health services have been intertwined with the funding streams for social services over time. So you can't really tell what's a social service and what's not, because we've combined, as I say, what other health care service do you go to the county to access to get your diagnosis and to figure out what your care plan is. That's not health care. That's a social service. And we've intertwined these mechanisms over time. So with the advent of health care reform, the state is receiving opportunity to do a better job in these areas with the health care dollar, access federal dollars, health care dollars. So conceptually,
these are now defined allowable costs in the basic health plans.
In the basic health plans.
That's what drives that, is the change of the language that clearly indicates parity here.
That's correct.
It's implementation of parity.
And conceptually, what we need to accomplish is dividing out what is clearly health care and getting health care paid for as health care, and getting social services, clearly this is social service. So I'm not saying that individuals don't need, they need health care services, and many of them may also need supportive social services. But until we get clearer with the funding streams, we as a state will continue to overpay into these systems that are all, I'll pick on consolidated funding. If you look at the funding streams, it's a braided funding stream. That's 22% county dollars. We also have probably about $20 million or 20% of that is federal block grant dollars, and the remainder is state dollars. SAMHSA has clearly sent us the signal to stop using the federal block grant dollars for health care. Okay? We should be starting to look at and changing how we use those federal block grant dollars for supportive services that are in addition to health care.
Is everybody sort of getting what's being said here? This is going to be a big river of change for us. And everybody sort of get it. Okay.
So that's kind of
I want to make
that.
Sure you have time to get through the rest of your stuff. I think this will be an exciting challenge for you to figure out.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just to add on, yourself, Senator Eaton, we attended a addiction studies grouping with as a state last summer, and part of the assignment there was to create some kind of a roadmap to what might some of this unwinding look like. And I would just share that here, that this is a very high-level, number-of-year plan, what it might look like. So as requested.
We have a copy of this in here somewhere?
Yes.
At the very back of your, oh, here. It's a separate sheet, everybody. Thank you.
So, again, this is just as completion of out of that addiction studies assignment as to, again, this is not a simple, because you unwinding a large system that would ultimately get you to a different substance abuse funding system. And if you look over to the left in the first column, the pilots this year, which is really just where we are today, is identifying the pilots have now been identified. And during the first year, what we're looking to do is just test for Minnesota direct access to a provider, use of telemedicine, some evidence-based practices, care coordination and recovery support services, and test these new services in these pilot areas. And these pilots are to be learning collaboratives so that there would might be legislation so we could have input from stakeholders across the state by next spring.
Just to be clear, are these pilots defined right now? And they've been selected.
They were just selected this week. We just contacted them.
So that's not something you can tell us
about. I could, if you, Madam Chair, if you'd like, I could do that. The list of the legislation said one in the metro, and that will be Dakota County. One in the south, which is Brown and Blue Earth, and then one in the north. That will be Clearwater, Hubbard, Milwaukee, Beltrami, and White Earth Red Lake are interested in participating. And again, the idea to these pilots were to test the different elements of these proposals in a multitude of different populations and settings. So they're just just in process of getting those underway.
And then the legislative adjustment that you're talking about in year two?
Is we would hope to bring forward, have recommendations around the learnings from those pilots and to bring forward the potential for a state plan amendment to create new services. So again, here's a basic principle, building new services before we do anything with the old system. So the old system stays in place, add systems, and then can adjust over time. And again, taking a look at these, this is a multi-year process in order to, and again, across the bottom, one of the big issues, workforce. This will call for workforce adjustments, so working on the workforce over time also.
And just as an aside, in order to make certain that the healthcare delivery system has in its basic plan clear language that authorizes expenditures for mental health and CD services more than the minimal amount. I mean, we can get into the same problem over there as the consolidated fund. It's such a narrow description of what's covered that it doesn't cover what you need covered in the healthcare side. Are you as a part of the development of what is expected coverage under the health coverage?
Madam Chair,
speaking
under
to that subject,
under these pilots that we're working with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and a number of the health plans are with us in these pilots helping to design, because again, this first stage is about learning collaboratives and getting all the relevant stakeholders to have discussions and to land on Minnesota services that can be supported.
So there has to be coverage in the healthcare system for these services in order to pay for them over there. And if that's, the money's not over there, then they're going to show up at the door. The county's still looking for support services. Okay, good.
Then I'll talk to a second topic, which is comprehensive detoxification or withdrawal management plan. Some of you familiar with, we have a growing problem in the state of Minnesota around our detoxification centers. A decade ago, we had 30 centers. We are now down to 22. Law enforcement is finding this an issue across the state. This is 100% county dollars that go into, and I'm sure many of you have heard this story before, it's 100% county dollars. Again, if you think about, is withdrawal management a healthcare condition? Are people that are needing to go into a detox, is that a healthcare condition? If we look at how we designed this as a public safety function only, you can kind of question that, but across other states, different components of detoxification are approved Medicaid benefits. Here in the state of Minnesota, we rely on 100% county funding for detoxification services. We recently had SAMHSA to the state to give us technical assistance around this issue. There's an organization that identifies levels of withdrawal management facilities, if you will, detox centers, and they are rated 1 through 5 is kind of the levels, 5 being the highest, which is a hospital detoxification. Our detox centers in the state of Minnesota are what's considered level four. There are 3 other levels, level 3, 2, and 1, identifying other ways to detoxify individuals. SAMHSA's recommendation to us is that we implement some of these other levels and apply for healthcare support, if you will, for these other levels of medical care that are available.
Yeah, that sounds like a, excuse me for interrupting. That sounds like something that's doable without having to wait for a 10-year timeline. Is this something that are the components that you need for a 1-2-3 level of service available in the state somewhere that we could I think we should move as quickly as we can towards drawing down federal health care dollars to help pay for these services. And is there any reason why the
Madam
timeline
Chair,
on that can't be this year?
Madam Chair, my opinion is we can move on it rapidly, but there's still a lot of conversation that needs to take place with law enforcement, public safety, healthcare providers. We haven't really conceptualized a time frame around that yet, but it sounds simpler. I agree. It sounds simpler than the other tasks, but they're both very similar tasks in that we've got an older system. How do we conceptualize new services and get them clearly in what can be healthcare, get them into healthcare, and
it is physiological, so it's one of those things that people don't have trouble understanding as a medical issue. It is a physiological crisis and stabilization process. So I'd like to hear what the timeline would be, and I would certainly encourage it be as quickly as possible.
And
counties would appreciate that enormously.
Well,
so would corrections. So would the correction system, because there are a lot of costs coming out of those systems for this that we might be able to capture dollars for in the healthcare, mm-hmm. out of healthcare.
And Madam Chair, one of the, I know for counties, taking law enforcement on the road away from their duties has become a large issue in greater Minnesota.
Absolutely.
In that as we've moved from 30 to 22 locations, law enforcement is being forced into making a lot of decisions because of the long distances in order to get services.
Right. Just transferring, I'm drawing a conclusion here, but just transferring this off of a social service system onto a county system, onto a Medicaid system or Medicare system, medical assistance system, this person becomes eligible if they're on those public programs, and many of them are, for non-emergency transportation paid for out of health care dollars, instead of asking a sheriff or a police officer to use their squad car to haul somebody from one, in rural Minnesota, it's from one city to another, because these detox centers are long distances away from the communities where the problem exists. So there's a lot of opportunity here. While we have to stumble along with pilot projects in some of the other areas, I don't see that as big a barriers here in making these changes.
Okay, and then lastly, continue to develop and implement the statewide substance abuse strategy. People familiar with that, that's our multiple agency work. We're almost at our one-year anniversary, we will be creating a document that really speaks to accomplishments of the first year, establishing outcomes for the different measures. This year, we had a large focus around the opiate problem in the state of Minnesota, really partnership between the pharmacy board, the health department, public safety, and DHS got some legislation passed last session to make a number of different changes to support the system. We've also done work currently developing a prevention framework, if you will, to address opiate issues and a synthetic issue that has been with young people around the state. So looking forward to continuing that work. It's become it's a first in the country with multiple agencies really uniting to do comprehensive substance abuse work.
I'm seeing our time, Assistant Commissioners. I know that I'm the one that's creating the problem here, so I'll try to be good if you can give us the highlights maybe on the rest of this so we don't run out of time.
Okay. Now I'll move to the Children's Mental Health Division. Again, like I said, with the gaps issue, it was hard to prioritize what are the issues that I would present to this group. So I tried to elevate a variety of the, higher profile issues. The first, develop services that meet the needs of children and adolescents attending intermediate school districts. And this really gets to, it's not just the intermediate school districts. And again, intermediate school districts are, there are the three that are in the metro area that children who have high needs of special education that are, can't be met in their regular school district may be referred to what's referred to as an intermediate school district. So these are specialty schools of children with high needs. And the intermediate districts have come forward clearly stating they do not have the resources to meet the needs of some of the children that are being referred to them. So that's the crux of this issue. And we do have a process underway. We have a first meeting in a few weeks with a variety of different agencies, DHS, along with the intermediate school districts. And I bring this up because it's not just the intermediate school districts, this a problem across the state. I mean, these three school districts, I think, take some of the kids with the most challenging behavioral presentations in the state. But we're really partnering together to try to figure out what are the needs that these children have that we can work on and under a variety of different topics.
Senator Clausen.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. There's been some discussion that educational settings are really inadequately prepared to deal with mental health issues. I don't know if you've seen some of that discussion recently. I guess I'm asking for your thoughts on that.
Senator Clausen, Madam Chair. Yes, I did see them, and I think that some of these meetings are really about those conversations. And I think, again, it's back to are we really considering institutionalizing some children and going backwards in time to the institutional mentality? Because I think that, there's a tendency to think that kids with high needs, like adults with high needs, should be institutionalized out of their homes. And I think that that's really at the crux of, if we move, and I'll pick on the adults first, moving adults out of institutions back to their communities, what are the supports and services that they need to be successful in their community? They need to go home, not to say that they might go for a short stay in some institution to get a particular piece of treatment. But the children, what we're talking about here, what's the length of stay that would be appropriate? Is it appropriate to send a child away for a year or 6 months? Or I mean, at the end of the day, they're coming back to the community, and we need to think through what are the services that they need to be successful in their community. And I think that's where these meetings are kind of coming back to, is Department of Human Services working with Department of Education to think through how are we going to do that? What are the needs of a child in order to get an education, be at home, or in, if it's foster care, then it's a foster care home, but be at home, get their services needs met during the day in appropriate proportion so they can stay in the community. So that's really what that gets to.
But is the, I'm reading through your mental health division, develop a psychiatric residential treatment facility level of care, development of a mechanism to provide mental health consultation to child care providers, which Senator Clausen's talking about supports in the schools, expand capacity to certified health care homes. And as you read through the bullets there, what I start to visualize is, especially if you're talking about, I like our psychologists in the schools program, for example, that provides specialized trained persons in the school. Instead of asking the school to be the mental health, the new residential treatment facility for mentally struggling children, mm-hmm. and making the school be adapting all of its classrooms and all of its curriculum to address behavioral problems rather than meeting its primary function, which is to educate students who for some reason or another, might not be there prepared to learn because of mental illness or starvation or toxic stress or who knows what. But, you know, I'm terribly concerned that we not ask the schools to be healthcare facilities. And so I don't disagree that we need, and I know that Senator Claussen doesn't mean I'm disagreeing with the idea that we need to integrate some help in the schools to meet this, but we have to be, there is a line between integration and not acknowledging that separation sometimes and creating a structured program that's supportive to kids is a good thing for them. And away from all the multiple stimuli and multiple pressures that occur in a school system. I think it's an unrealistic expectation to have that kind of integration, if that's what we're talking about here.
And Madam Chair, having run adolescent program in the past, if you look at some children, they're not able to do a full academic day, and they also may not need a full therapeutic day. So I think the answer lies in how can we design some services. Maybe some children may need 4 hours of education and 4 hours of treatment, let's say, per day. So where are the models that we may develop that allow children to stay at home and be supported in their community adequately?
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of the issues that I ran across, I was working with the autism community and I'm on the task force, is that in the public school systems especially, there were an unwillingness or an inability or lack of resources to deal with children who could not deal with a lot of outside stimuli and things like that. And they ended up with their children being more disciplined and things like that than any kind of education. I'm just thinking, you know, maybe we need to look at teachers going into the home or some kind of, you know, there may need to be a different kind of teaching for some people. And we're pretty structured into the classroom 8 hours or whatever. And there's a lot of children that just really can't sit still that long. You know, I'm a little frustrated with our current system, I guess.
Senator Eaton, Madam Chair.
I think that Senator Eaton is, we really, you talk about history of, you know, there's been this huge desire to integrate people, deinstitutionalize, move back into the community, have, even in the Olmstead Act, the persons with disabilities to be able to have choices that allow as full an integration as possible in their lives to the community life, whatever that might be, without a lot of barriers to that. But there is a reality that though the vision and the desire might be that they have the capacity to integrate and that the capacity isn't developed because of mental illness or other problems. That the problem isn't that the systems aren't there to integrate them, it's the illness makes it difficult for them to utilize systems that are in place. So I support broader integration, lots of options, the correct level of care for the level of acuity or disease. Mm-hmm. But I don't like destroying systems for others in order to achieve that objective.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, and again, just a couple of comments on that. One, I have concerns about the movement of children with mental illness into the criminal justice system because they're having behaviors in the schools. There's a leaning in that direction, which we've seen in other areas. I don't think that's the correct direction. We need to, again, be identifying if there are mental health issues. We should be addressing them appropriately. And a lot of the other slide does get to some of these different issues that there are support services that we can do better at. As a for instance, crisis services is one of the things I think of. What's the crisis management system? Are we using crisis behavioral crisis management systems as opposed to law enforcement? Are we using those kinds of interventions as we really think through with the intermediate school districts what's possible.
Well, maybe we should move on. Yeah. I'm concerned about our time here.
And likewise, the second item, we know that we need this development of a psychiatric residential treatment facility level of care. We do not have that in the state of Minnesota. We have residential care that is not medically managed, if you will. It's a more of a straight residential level of care, and there are children that could benefit. We are sending some children out of state because we don't have this level of care in the state of Minnesota. And again, this relatively short length of stay. It's not inpatient. It's kind of the immediate level below that, but it's still medically managed. So it's active treatment, so people would return. But it's recognizing that this, for a small number of kids, this gap between inpatient care and going back to their community without establishing long periods of time away from home. The next one, mechanism to provide health care consultation to child care providers. Kind of tied in with Aaron Sullivan's presentation that child care providers often are managing very challenging behaviors, providing consultation to them to keep kids on a good track. And then the last one I mentioned earlier, expand the capacity of our healthcare homes to manage children appropriately. What's the capacity in that system, because children will receive that their primary care clinic is where they receive their health care, and are we treating them appropriately in those settings and trying to expand that capacity in primary care to appropriately screen, monitor, or refer children. Next, I'll talk about the Adult Mental Health Division. Some significant topics there, development of behavioral health home. I just wanted, this is one of those tools coming from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid that is really a gift to us, if you will, to states as a transformational tool. The more I have learned about this as a tool, states have used this in many different ways. It's designed for individuals with a behavioral health diagnosis and co-occurring chronic medical other condition. Could be substance abuse, could be diabetes, could be whatever, but people with serious mental illness automatically qualify for a behavioral health home. And we are currently working with others to create this framework. I had a little bit of an eye-opening experience listening to other states, what other states had done. There was one state, the only healthcare home, behavioral health home they had implemented was in methadone clinics. There were others that they had many, many different ones, models, and it was a very competitive marketplace. And there was another one that it was just an extra benefit that the managed care entities managed. So there's a wide range of potential in the state of Minnesota to use this tool. So it's underway. Improve the coordination of our crisis response system. I put this just last session was funded an expansion of our mobile crisis teams. So that's underway with being implemented. And I just wanted to point out that we really have a quite fragmented call system. It's like, how do you actually contact and connect with a service, let's say like a mobile crisis team? Every county is mandated to have a system. So you can imagine how that works across the state. Is what agency do you actually get? So we're thinking about this just in terms of, from a system standpoint, how do we have an effective, efficient system of dispatch if we're talking about detoxification services? How do you dispatch to detox? How do you dispatch mobile crisis teams? How do you do suicide call lines? I mean, there's just an array of services out there that we really haven't considered. Is there a way to really have a high-quality way to have the service and a simple way to access so that people know what phone number do I call if I'm having, and you know, again, we're trying to move upstream how do we get the people the services they need? I can't tell you how many complaints I hear of people call and the call center or whoever they call says, nope, we don't handle that one. We don't handle that kind of crisis. Again, that kind of an issue. Identify and implement strategies for reducing non-acute bed inpatient bed days. I know everyone has heard this at length. I just wanted to bring up one point around that, and that's our psychiatric bed capacity as we stand today, because it's really one of the big drivers. I've heard the debate, do we have enough beds? The data says we're running 95 to 97% capacity of our psychiatric beds in the state of Minnesota, all beds, on a daily basis, which we know is not enough. At the same time, we know that we've got many non-acute bed days going on. So where do we need to make the adjustment? Do we go back to the old system and add more inpatient beds, which is the system as the system used to be, or do we continue to really as rapidly as possible solve the community placement issue and get people placed back in their community? Again, just to kind of bring that up, that if all of the non-acute bed days were resolved, we would not have a need for that extra capacity. But as we stand today, there are people having a hard time accessing
what's being done
beds.
To resolve the non-acute bed. And we hear this, this is, again, describing a problem that's been described and described and described. We have backups in all the psychiatric hospitals, can't get their patients out of a hospital bed into the acute, into the high-intensive care treatment at Anoka or at St. Peter. They're held in St. Peter because they can't get them back into the community. And constantly, I mean, I got to tell you, Mr. Commissioner, I've heard this, we don't have enough supports, we can't get Anoka issue resolved because there's not community-based services. So where is the proposal, and what are the initiatives that are in place to get us past describing this problem over and over again?
Madam Chair, the assessment's been completed. There's a list of interventions to take place.
Is this the flow assessment that's been done, the flow of patients through the system? Is that?
They're related. I mean, the actual barrier list of what's keeping people, what are the things that need to happen in the community in order to get people moved out of these non-acute beds.
That's completed.
So the assessment is completed, and the interventions around those should be forthcoming shortly.
Into the next session?
Before the next session, yes.
Are these resolutions that it can occur without legislative intervention?
Many of them.
Okay.
Yes. And then lastly, develop strategies to improve access to urgent psychiatric services. This is one that has bubbled up in terms of we've got crisis services, and yet we still have individuals who are decompensating in the community that aren't appropriate to go to the hospital, and yet they're not able to access the level of service that they need. And I'm just kind of flagging this one because it's just has bubbled up, and we're looking at that along with some other organizations as to what might we be able to do. And then I'll move to and then some of issues are really overall administration goals. We've talked about this already, develop a comprehensive and adequate workforce. We've talked about this in many different ways. Number two, develop culturally competent services and reduce disparities. I had a quite robust conversation last hour about this. We have an internal committee and are trying to look at ways to reach out to different communities of color, if you will, and engage in what, again, trying to drill down as to what those issues are. We've done a lot of work with our American Indian tribes. We had a summit here this last year and are looking at developing work plans with the individual tribes. Again, many issues. I believe it's two of the tribes have actually declared public health emergencies. And a big part of it, not only the issues that Aaron Sullivan talked about last hour, but issues around opiate addiction alcoholism, all of the things that got mental health issues. So working hard with them, other culturally services, veteran services. We run one of the highest veteran suicide rates nationally. This is another population that doesn't come up. We have a grant that we're working on.
I'm going to have you repeat that. What I just heard you say is compared to other states,
yes.
Minnesota has one of the highest, is among the highest states in suicides in our veteran population.
Yes.
Do we have an analytics on that? Do we understand why that is? Or are we at that phase of analysis? Why is it higher in Minnesota than other places?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I know we're forming a Veterans Advisory Committee. We did receive a federal grant around this, so we're doing work with a number of different agencies, so we are working on it, but I do not know the answer to why is that in the state of Minnesota.
But I just want to make sure I understood you, that you are developing a process to get an answer to that question.
Madam Chair, yes. Okay. And then I was just going to touch briefly. I mentioned earlier that in the area of behavioral health services, we haven't done a great job over time on outcomes. I'll just kind of acknowledge that. A lot of the outcome data that we have is more based in specific grants. We manage a great many grants. The Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division manages 125 grants alone for specific populations. All three divisions manage grants. So a lot of the data that we have about outcome measures are really targeted on smaller populations. So I thought I would just share with you a few of the different outcome measures that we are measuring today. One, number of students receiving mental health services for the first time. That's really linked back to our school link grants and looking for that outcome to make sure that that's making a difference. Children receiving intervention from mobile mental health crisis teams. The school link grants are also measuring children of color receiving mental health services is also a subset in that.
Are these dashboards numbers served, that kind of thing, rather than you know, that's one measure is how many have we been able to serve, but it doesn't really tell us whether the intervention has changed the health status of the person receiving the care.
Madam Chair, we do have a few measures that kind of get to did services improve the mental health condition. There are fewer of those. This is a more typical measures in some of these programs because that other data is difficult to get and it's in targeted populations. We do have smaller subsets of because again then you have to administer a different sets of questionnaires in order to attain did somebody actually get better or not. Is it just another level of data collection? So we have some studies, especially around children, where we've done that work.
Well, you heard the earlier discussion. Mm-hmm. I think our committee is very interested in not spending money on a program that just has numbers as its measurement. We don't want to be throwing money in a system, especially around health disparities, that keeps serving but doesn't seem to change the mark. And I don't know why there are so many grants, why they can't get consolidated, but I think our committee is going to continue to drive that question that we want that changed. Somehow the measures have to be changed. I don't know if the federal government determines what those measures are or what the problem is, but it isn't helping us change our dashboards. Then we have to change. We have to understand why that is.
Madam Chair,
and the dashboards have to be something more than number. We've served so many people ineffectively. We served hundreds of people ineffectively.
So. And that's why I kind of like number three, newborn testing negative for alcohol and drug exposure. Again, we've got 10 programs that are monitoring, working with pregnant women to monitor this. And again,
there was a program. I don't want to take you off because you've got 15 minutes left. There was a program, I think it was on some public program, about withdrawal in infants from opiate addiction, which is a terrible thing to watch, and that is extremely high. And I was wondering whether or not that is an issue of some magnitude in the state, even if it's not of magnitude in the state of Minnesota. Because we have had the reason I'm asking this is because we put a policy in place that there didn't require reporting of drug testing to social services so that the social service system could intervene under the child protection services, that we wanted to take away the sphere of reporting what chemical use history was so that the care provider would hear the data. And in that way, we would maybe reduce the number of children that had alcohol syndrome or opiate withdrawal. So we have a policy about that that doesn't require the county to go in and assess this family based on what the healthcare provider discovers about chemical use. But this program indicated that this was a significant problem, opiate withdrawal in babies. So,
again, Madam Chair,
we
it's
have
a
policies related to that. So.
It continues to be an issue, and it continues to be an issue. We have 10 grantees. Program grantees that serve a variety of different substances used by the women, but that is the goal of this grant is to actually reduce the amount of substance used during pregnancy.
And
this is the measure of that the programs testings. Are using. Number four, adults in mental health rehabilitation receiving substance abuse screening. And again, these are about program improvements so that people in that's referred to as ESPRT being taking place in the ERTS programs. And lastly, adults in assertive community treatment receiving annual physical exams. Again, the 10x10 program of trying to is getting baseline and making sure that people in those ACT teams get physicals and are connected with primary care. Again, just kind of, I thought I would do some brief overview of some of the finances. This graph shows our federal funds that we received and anticipated for fiscal year 14-15. In the area, this was the first time that the federal government requested us to do a joint proposal between substance abuse and mental health, that they wanted one application. It's kind of an indication of, again, those services working together. $42 million on the chemical dependency block grant side and $21 million designated on the mental health side at this point. And those are for a wide range of services that we use those for. And if you can look down below, the mental health block grant, $21 million. Mental health, and the difference between the two, mental health block grant dollars, federal government dictates some broad categories to accomplish with those dollars. And then we create grants and ways to spend those dollars. The other category, the second one there, mental health federal grants, other, those are very specific where the federal government's really kind of passed through. They say this is the way specifically these dollars need to be spent. Likewise, on the chemical dependency side, so a significant some of the kinds of programs that we fund out of that federal block grant, let me just kind of touch bases, homelessness, criminal justice, American Indian, recovery care, primary care support are all grants that are funded out of those federal dollars. And I thought I would just touch bases on the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Fund to have a little bit of understanding of how that breaks down. I talked about it earlier.
May I just ask a question? You know, you have these grants that you're distributing. We have requests all the time in the form of bills for expenditures of dollars towards special projects of these sort. And they all sound wonderful, and they all have value when they come in front of our committee.
Right.
But there's a finite amount of money here, so if one gets funded, another doesn't. Is that typically what it is? And do we have a sense of some – parameters or some, have we had discussions about what that, I mean, I'm not articulating myself very well here, I'm sorry. I'm trying to figure out how, I mean, we're looking at how this money is distributed now, but for us, we have these requests for these grants, and then we approve them, and then it's funded out of these funding streams. But you can't fund everything. So do we have a, what do we have that helps us say no to one proposal over another?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
There are broad categories where we would be trying to accomplish. Let's say the topic we just had was pregnant women, and that was a category that federal government was interested in block grant category, and then we would identify and develop an RFP and then distribute that and programs.
So is that defined by the federal government? Are they defining the ways in which these dollars are to be spent so that there's no real flexibility at the state level around this?
In these larger federal block grant dollars, they identify that, as a for instance, 25% of our federal block grant needs to be spent on Native American services. So at that level, they're saying that you're going to use a certain percentage of your block grant in this direction. They don't say any more than that. But they give us some broad categories as the federal government sets their priorities and passes them to us. And then we have discretion within those. Homelessness is another category where we're to be accomplishing something. And, again, then we can determine within that.
So would it be fair to say that when the department brings proposals forward for funding, that they are working within those prescribed? We simply accept what the priorities are that are established for funding by the federal government, and that we just follow with making proposals based on that set of criteria?
The funding for the federal block grant would not go through the legislative process, those decisions. So the legislative proposals that would be coming from the department would be for dollars, additional dollars, than what the federal government is already granting us out of the federal block grant.
But would they be matching dollars? Are they matching dollars?
No, they're not.
So they're completely separate programming, not defined by that. So when
Right. You
say that you're the singular authority, it's these grants that you're talking about that come to you with these broad parameters for how it should be spent, and then you, without legislative participation, can formulate expenditures.
That's correct.
How do we understand this? How do we get what's happening here? Because it seems to me that it relates to gaps and us understanding how we want to spend whatever resources we're going to spend in these areas.
The federal block grant that we submit to the federal government every year for these funds would be a way to disseminate and to have discussion around, or at least be knowledgeable about what's in the federal block grant application that's coming from Minnesota. I think that would be the way to understand what's happening there and to align priorities.
So when the department determines for the 25% for the tribal expenditures, mm-hmm. how you're going to spend that by putting out requests, you're doing some work around that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that work have to be approved at the federal level then before you can distribute those grants, or you don't have any other authority once that is distributed to you?
Madam Chair, that's correct, that we would take a grant process, I mean, and then we would say this is how we're going to we have parameters from the federal government as to how to spend it. We would follow an appropriate procedure, if you will, for distributing the dollars through a grants process or some other reasonable process.
You know, I find this very interesting because I think in this earlier discussion we were talking about disparities mm-hmm. and institutional racism.
Mm-hmm.
That we're trying, and I think what we could do, I'm just mm-hmm. talking to you now as a legislator, is establish some priorities for how these, to direct the department to use a certain set of priorities when looking at the distribution of tribal dollars, for example. We could do that, right?
Madam Chair, yes.
Or we could say we don't want our department to accept these dollars at all.
Could go in that direction also.
So I'm just talking about what our authority is. So
right.
We could tie we could participate in this. So mm-hmm. I would like to see us understand better how you're these are dollars that are being big bucks being distributed without us understanding how you're setting the priorities, how it's going out, and without us really participating and making certain that this other big factor besides the veterans who are dying mm-hmm. from suicide, that we're the highest of states in health disparities for Indians and African Americans. So, I mean, I you can hear that this is becoming really a critical issue for us. We're going to be targeting that a lot in our conversations in the next legislative session.
Madam Chair, and I think we'd welcome that participation and policy discussion around it. I think what you'd find is, again, I kind of go back to the dollars are already being distributed in that way for the most part around homeless, around disparity kinds of issues. You'll find within the grants a lot of the emphasis is already in that direction. But again, a better understanding of how many dollars are going in what direction. And the truth of it is a lot of these systems, I'll kind of go back to one way that you manage a system that's underfunded is you do it with grants. Because then you can fund one program over here as if you're taking on an issue when you actually have a whole area that needs funding. It's few dollars on some of these issues as opposed to, and I think that's a fundamental.
Right. We did it with the bonding problem. Bill. We sent it off to a department to make some priority decisions when we didn't fund it adequately. So I understand that. But what I'm
goes up too.
But it also creates a situation in which the department decided what the priorities were for the bonding bill.
Yeah.
And like I said, that's a problem. That's a problem for some of us.
And like I say, Madam Chair, we'd welcome that policy conversation and sharing that information.
We're going to have you wrap up. Do you want to hit a couple more highlights here? What do you think are critical points? Yes.
Well, let me just kind of jump forward here just a little bit. Olmstead Plan, I don't know how much information people would like to have.
One of the things that's being requested is, can you give us larger
sure, yes.
images of these last slides? They're so small, like this one here. Well, we have this framework. We have that one, don't we?
Right. And I just kind of put that there to just kind of talk about alignment, that a number of items that I've talked about are actually the same, are listed on here. It's the SchoolLink grants, ESPERT, primary care integration are all alignment of CMHS with this broader document from DHS.
We don't have this one? We didn't have it today, but we have had this. Isn't this the department's?
Yes, that's the department.
Yeah, we should. We'll get you a copy of this because this has been distributed last when Commissioner Jessen was here.
it was in
the previous PowerPoint.
And the previous PowerPoint. Okay. So but we'll, it is the graphs that you have on here, if we could get larger.
A bigger version. And with that, my last closing is just I continue to reiterate that behavioral health is healthcare. And I think that that's kind of a vision as to what does that look like as we move in policy determinations and what would that look like in the world. So,
more questions. Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Do you coordinate the needs of the state with what you're getting in federal grants with what you request in state funds? Are we working together is what I'm trying to say. Is the federal grant or the federal funds administration of to programs talking to the state funds administration to programs? I mean, are they coordinated?
Senator Eaton, Madam Chair, I would say yes. The grant cycles, because of their length, most of them are on a five-year cycle, minimum three-year, but most of them are on a five-year cycle. So as they get distributed, the policy discussion should take place as to how best to spend. And again, many of these are already in categories, let's mm-hmm. say from the federal government, let's say homelessness. They say a certain percentage is going to be homelessness. So we would coordinate with other efforts going on as those grants become due to make sure that they're fitting into whatever other plans are going on around homelessness or what's the need there, if that answers your question.
Well, for example, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Eaton.
If you have this pot of money going to, what do you say, clothing for homeless people, I mean, it wouldn't make sense to have the state do the same thing. And you know, I'm just wondering if that's being coordinated so we're getting the biggest bang for the bucks, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So that you don't have a whole bunch of money going to one thing and nothing going to the other, and they're both equal needs.
Senator Eaton, Madam Chair, I would say those kinds of things are coordinated, okay, in that the dollars that are being requested from the legislature are dollars that would be inefficiently or more broadly needed, let's say, than some of these targeted grants that are coming through the block grant.
Okay. Well, I think it might, you know, when a bill comes forward, you might ask, are there other, would people be in the, you know, that are representing the department, if we ask the question of a person who's at the table presenting a proposal for expenditures out of the state side of the money, if we said what of this problem is being funded through the federal grants that are distributed without coming through the legislature, we could get an answer in a committee hearing to that?
Madam Chair, if they were prepared for that, the person testifying might not have that. So we would need to prepare that individual, yeah, for that. And I think it's a good point, though.
Yeah, and it's just that when bills come up, mm-hmm, this it might be just a heads up that maybe that question would be asked. You're tracking those bills, so you know, getting that information to somebody that might be in the hearing room would be helpful.
We'll get prepared for that.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you another question too. The coordination. Oh, but the other thing is, you can also bring a rationale to saying we're going to target what federal money there is with some state money because we think it's inadequate. If we had more resources and really did a major initiative of combining these resources, we could have an impact. But if you piecemeal it out in this way, it's a lot of money being spent, but it's not really enough to change the bar. You know, that's the other problem. It's just sort of everybody gets a little, and then you really don't move the bar very much. Okay, other questions? I have a question. Thank you very much. This was great. I appreciate it. It's hard to hold enough people here to take advantage of what an opportunity is for us to learn from you. So thank you for coming here today. We have in the future, I just want to run this by those of you who are still here. Senator Claussen has created this wonderful idea to have us have these kinds of meetings. I think it's great for me. It's great for everyone. I would like to continue to do that. We have only so much of your time that we can spend, though. I know you have other demands on your time. A couple of things that we've planned that are orientation-type things are a trip to St. Peter for all of the members of this committee and the Finance Committee to see, and we're going to have you see state-operated services there, a security hospital. What else, Chelsea? We're going to try to help you see a variety of these different kinds of services, maybe a crisis center and community behavioral health center, that those resources are in that region. We can hit more than one at one time if we go there.
We are in the process of planning it. It's
not finalized. I hope. Are you interested in that as an orientation kind of idea? And then what's the other one we were talking about?
Chemical health facility.
Maybe a chemical health treatment facility. Is there an interest in that? Maybe. I'm not sure. Yes.
Anything in the area of youth mental health services, perhaps?
Yes,
we could explore?
Yes. I think that would, in our discussions, I thought that if we had to choose between a chemical dependency treatment program, which all you can see is the rooms, you know, you don't really see treatment programs, but there is an opportunity. There is the Leo Hoffman Adolescent Treatment Facility that's on the campus of the St. Peter Security Hospital. Mm-hmm. We could work it in if we didn't do a chemical dependency treatment. We can't do both because we can't get enough in a day. And that's not a state-operated service. It's a not-for-profit, I think, organization, but it's on the state campus. But it might be worth having a look at that if that would be your priority over a chemical dependency treatment center.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So
I have to check and see.
We have to see if we can even go there because it's not our facility. But we're trying to put a couple of things like that together. But I'd like to continue this kind of dialogue. I think especially when we have a mix of members and parties, that it creates more dialogue and conversation than, you know, conflicted conversation. So, you know, if you like this and if we're interested in it, we'll continue to do this. I think the department likes the opportunity to come and really have more than 15 minutes to sort of lay out an issue in front of us. So if you like it, we'll continue to, we can even continue to do it through the session if we have enough time, although it's an awfully short session. Anyway, we're working on trying to provide more. So I appreciate everybody's coming. I think it's good for us. I want to repeat also, if you weren't here, there was a report at the actual committee hearing that we had last week on the value of the managed care programs and an analysis of that with fee-for-service. If you haven't pulled that document up and spent some time with it, it really is worth your time. I may come back at that, not only for the discussion of the comparison of the value, but in the document there's great orientation to the various models of service delivery in the state, because they're defined and described simply, and it's just a great orientation document. So I just want to refer everybody back to that. All right, great. So then that concludes today's orientation.